Okay, welcome to Not the Wikipedia Weekly or whatever it's being called now. I am user Skartle, and I am being joined by a number of our friends here to talk about the process of improving and refining articles. Let's go around and introduce ourselves. Moni, why don't you go next?
Hi, I'm Moni3.
And I am a Wadawit.
And I am Phil.
Excellent. All of us have worked on articles, improving them, getting them to higher status than they were before. And so we thought we'd start where a lot of Wikipedia articles start, that is in stub class or stub status. And I guess the first criteria is, we don't need to go into the whole notability thing, but starting a stub article. When do you
Well,
do it and how do you do it right?
actually, I write two different kinds of stubs. I write stubs that I'm intending to create good articles or featured articles out of, and I write stubs that I'm not intending to do anything further with. I'm just going to leave them for other people to improve. And the articles that I'm just leaving for other people to improve, I usually just source to like a single source that I know is reliable, so like a specialist encyclopedia or something, and they're usually just a few paragraphs long, and they cover the major topics related to that subject, but they don't go into any depth. But I just want to know that it has a reliable, at least one reliable source there for it. But the stubs that I'm going to create a much larger article around, I actually usually include a very large bibliography for at the same time that I'm making it, so that like all the sources I want to use to create the article are there from the beginning.
And is that for your purpose mostly, or is that for other people as well?
I mean, I use it for myself. Of course, it would be lovely if other people helped out. That's never happened.
Was going to ask if you ever had somebody stumble along and say, "Oh, I think I'll pick this up."
No. You wish it would
I
happen.
usually, I usually start articles as start class instead of stubs because I'm trying to get a do you know tag off of it, and I have to do it all within 5 days with good citations, and I usually don't have the time to come back after I create a stub of several sentences and create something like a B class article. So I try to post it as either a start class or B class article.
Yeah, I know what you mean, and we'll come back to discussion about some of that, and we'll come back to sandboxing and things.
Well,
All right. Anything else about stub,
I'm a big fan
Phil?
of stubs, and I've written several hundred stubs, and I concentrate more on that stub and start end of the article spectrum than I do on the GA and FA end of the spectrum, in opposition to some other people. I think a nice tight stub or start that really you don't expect to go any place beyond a stub or a start can be quite helpful. Not that there isn't a place for having more GAs and FAs, which I support, but I think there's a lot of place to fleshing out, particularly in the humanities, our red links by creating stubs and starts. We are extremely deficient in lots of areas, articles that are just crying out to be written, and we don't have them. And sometimes in some kind of amazing areas, actually. It's amazing what we don't cover. So I'm a big fan of stubs and
So just to play
starts.
devil's advocate then. Yeah, just to play devil's advocate then, I guess my question would be, is it better to have a tiny mention about, say, a book or a story containing information that most people probably know anyway, than it is to have no article at all?
Well, that's a good question. I've actually had a few articles that have a lot of red links in them, and some people come along behind me and create the red links out of almost exactly the same wording that's in the larger article that I've already posted. And in that case, I'm not sure it's that much better because it just says the exact same thing as what's in the article that I've just written. And I really don't like the fact that some of the words that I've used are copied, and it doesn't really give the reader any other greater understanding about the subject than they already have.
I would agree
This
with
comes to the
Moni.
question of what's a good stub, right? I mean, what really is a good stub? Earlier, actually in the chat, we were talking about stubs, and I showed Kartal what I considered a stub that I had just written on the Eclectic Review, which was a journal published in the 19th century. And Scartel, when you looked at it, you said it wasn't a stub. And
well, it just,
why
it just,
do you think it's not a stub?
Well, I would say that it doesn't fit what I generally think of when I think of a stub. I'm imagining, you know, at most 3 or 4 sentences, no section headings, you know, one of those cute little tags at the bottom saying, oh, this is a stub.
That's a stub, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. And it has like a 3-paragraph lead. It has 4 sections, and I mean, it has multiple paragraphs. But one of the reasons I consider it a stub is because it is sourced entirely to one article in one specialist encyclopedia. So there really is no verification beyond this, you know, one scholar's view about what the Eclectic Review was like. You know, and so now I've basically replicated that information here, you know, reorganized it, put in, you know, the details that person had, and that's all we've got. So that's one reason I view it as a stub.
Sure. Phil, you had your hand up. Did you want to say something about stubs?
Yeah, I would agree with Moni. I personally don't think it's worth making a stub unless it contributes new information. Now, I think we discussed the last time I weighed in that I really believe all articles should be able to stand on their own. I don't want to force the reader to have to click endlessly links. Their finger gets pretty tired from doing all that clicking, and they get lost in a maze of a graph structure, a tree structure, so deep they can't remember what they were looking for originally. So all articles should be self-contained with a little bit of information, I believe. So you shouldn't neglect good writing style just because you've got the ability to produce links in it and make hyperlinks. But the hyperlink should have something unique or special to it. Otherwise, it's not even worth making it. I mean, it just to make it, just to get the red out, it seems sort of dumb to me. And but there is still, I would say, in certain areas, in spite of the fact that we've got, 2.5 million articles in English Wikipedia, there are still lots and lots of areas where it's really surprising that important topics have almost no information about them. And
I'm working on the Maya Angelou's autobiography, I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings, and she, you know, half of her books at least are red links, which is very surprising to me given the popularity of her writing.
It can be quite surprising the kind of things that are left out. I'm just when I wander around, it never ceases to amaze me what we don't have in all kinds of
areas. But you can rest assured that every Naruto character has his or her own page, or at the very least, a link will be redirected to something that gives us the information we need. Okay, let's go ahead and move on from stubs. If let's say we've chosen a topic, we're interested in making it a better article, what is the next step?
Well, for me, that's clearly research.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. I want to see more references.
Yeah, research for me, too, is just going hunting down everything I can possibly read about something.
Mm-hmm. Where do you start? Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, what is the research methodology that you use? Everyone has a different way of finding materials. What you know, how do you find the sources that you're going to use for writing these articles?
Well, I'll tell you what I do.
Well, first I start. Go ahead, Phil.
We haven't heard from Moni in a little bit. Go ahead, Moni. Let's start with you, and then we'll come back to Phil.
Okay. All right. Well, first I start with what's most available to me, and that's just what's at my fingertips. And it may be whatever book I'm reading that's associated with the article that I'm writing right now, or a topic that I just find interesting. And then I'll do like a Google search and find out what's available in the first 2 pages. And then I'll check the library that's close to me. And see what they have in books, and then I'll start looking for newspaper articles and then journal articles on JSTOR or whatever is available there. And there is at some point a point where I just start looking at the notes section of the bibliographies of books that I'm already reading, and then I start picking up more and more and more until I have to go to what seems to be really far lengths to find the books and the sources that I'm looking for.
For those who don't know, JSTOR is an online database that has a lot of academic articles on it. Phil?
Yeah, what I do My first glance is I will look at, say, the first 100 or 200 hits in Google. And a lot of times those will have links in those, so it can be a little bit of a lengthy process. And I will read those, not all of them will be relevant, of course, and try to keep some notes. I will also go to my local library, which has a lot of electronic databases built into it. I'll look at the books, I'll look at the electronic databases. Also, I will mention, when I go to Google, I just don't do a regular Google search. I will look at Google Books as well, and Google Scholar, and a lot of times that will give certain clues. Sometimes Google isn't quite good enough, so I will use some of the other search engines, like Dogpile I like, or which lumps together about 10 search engines. Or eventually I would like, there are these deep web search tools, which will actually go to stuff that's not indexed by the search engines. And I haven't explored those yet, but I have in mind trying that to dig out things that are a little more hidden. Only about 10% or so, I think, of the web is searchable by regular search engines. Some people have specialized databases, like at the Library of Congress, or I've gone to the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris and so on to look at their collections. Sometimes what I'll do for a little bit of a, this is kind of cheating, but if I'm dealing with an article that has much better articles in the other languages, say Portuguese or Spanish, French, German, Russian, I'll look at those. I can read the French. I can kind of fight my way through the German, sort of. I'll use translation tools to kind of get the regular gist of it, and a lot of times they'll have better references that I can look up, sometimes in English, sometimes in some other language, and then again I'll use the translation tools, and I can use those clues to try to build up a better picture of what's going on. So I use everything that comes close to me to try it. Newspapers as well. Sometimes I'll ask reference librarians to help me.
Yeah, I remember a lot of it. One time you mentioned something about how you found it useful to look in a book that is about the subject and then see what the bibliography of that book has in it, and you can sort of find certain texts showing up again and again. I've actually reached a point, I have to say, first of all, thank you very much to Jay Henry, the user of Wikipedia, who at one point mentioned to me that I live right near the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Duh, they have a great library. Maybe I could go in and, if not get, you know, an actual membership to check out books, I could go in and make photocopies and take notes and whatnot. Well, it turns out that since I'm a high school English teacher in the region, I was allowed to get an actual membership. So now, whenever I'm going to find a topic, you know, Emmeline Pankhurst is my most recent example, I went in and I just found every book that mentioned her, you know, and I just sort of checked it out and ended up with 20 books, you know, breaking my back. And then, you know, as I go through, I decide, okay, this book isn't very useful, you know, I need to go back and get this other book, which I didn't think I needed. You know, having that access to, you know, if you live near a university library, they can be infinitely useful in this sort of work. And thanks to both you and him for those suggestions there. Wadawa, did you have anything about source finding? Or?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that is, of course, is very important to remember is that each, like, discipline is extremely different. So, like, I once tried to start researching a medical article, and I realized I really have no idea how to do that. And it would take me a really long time to learn. You actually develop an expertise in learning how to research. And if you've never done any research before, it's going to take sort of a long time to learn how to do that.
I learned that on EmmyKnowThrough, yeah.
Yeah. And for example, in the humanities, there are often introductory books that are written for undergraduates. So, like, there's a Cambridge Companion series on authors and literature that is supposed to introduce you in a sort of easy, accessible way to an author. So, for example, when I started working on the Mary Shelley article, I went and I got that book, and in the back, it lists specifically the biographies that are important to read on Mary Shelley and the important scholarly secondary works. And I just started reading all of those. So that's helpful because that's already been sort of culled for you by someone else. And there are these kinds of things in other disciplines. And the minute you can start to identify what those are in the disciplines in which you work, it makes finding the sources much easier because there's a lot of stuff written on Mary Shelley, and I'm not going to be able to read all of it. But if someone who has an expertise in that area has already said, no, you don't have to read all of it. Here are the five biographies that you should read. Right. You know, that already helps enormously. So,
yeah, I would also, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, so I was going to say, for example, in the Mary Shelley article, that's exactly what we did, is we started with that baseline of text, and we read those few biographies and those few secondary works, so that we didn't have to read hundreds of books and articles on Mary Shelley. You know, we only had to read, you know, 30 or 40 instead.
Yeah, and one thing I noticed that was very nice, I hope this is a trend in biographies, when doing the Harriet Tubman article and Emmeline Pankhurst, a number of the books started off, the most recent biography started off with a bit of a survey of other things that had been written about this person, and that was very helpful, because then when I went and looked at Bradford in the case of Tubman, or, you know, other things in the case of Pankhurst, I had an idea of where that writer was coming from and what to expect from it. So, you know, even if you do go back to those older sources, you have some sort of framework, you know what you're working with there. The other thing you had mentioned 1.0 out of it is that there's an important difference between university presses, for instance, and popular publication, you know, companies that publish books just for general audiences. And I don't know if you wanted to mention something about that here.
Yeah, scholars who write biographies or secondary works for university presses, those works are generally much more respected within the scholarly community, and they've been reviewed by scholars. Things that are published by trade presses, even if they're written by scholars, are not necessarily reviewed by other scholars. They may have been, but they aren't necessarily so. And oftentimes they're selected because people believe that they'll sell well. So you could actually find interesting reviews of a recent Cicero biography, for example, that will explain other scholars have reviewed and said, yeah, you know, this is an interesting sensationalistic story of Cicero, and we have no doubt that this was chosen because it will sell well, but it's not very accurate.
Interesting.
You know,
I'm curious.
Particularly interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious, Moni, about, you know, something like the Everglades. When you started working on that, that's such a huge topic, and surely there's been so much written. How did you go about narrowing down your sources for that one?
Well, you know, it's a lot has been written about it, but definitively, I was surprised to find the group of sources were really small. So I actually ended up buying most of the sources I used for the Everglades articles, and a lot of it was biology, a lot of it was geology, and some stuff that I really didn't have a lot of experience with. But I kind of got it, and I understand what Awado was talking about with medical articles, that you kind of have to teach yourself what you're doing, and sometimes you've realized that you're really out of you know, it's over your head. But I used a lot of books and then in newspaper articles, and surprisingly, I didn't find a lot of journal articles that would be readily accessible for people who were interested in the Everglades. They were very specialized about populations of wading birds, or, you know, one type of fish or one type of duck or something like that, and I'm not sure that you know, general readers would have been interested in that.
But you'll be ready when you need to write an article about that one type of bird. So was it a chicken or an egg type of thing? Was it that you had decided to do articles on all of these different aspects of the Everglades, or did you buy the books and then you said, well, I have all these books, I might as well do these other articles as well?
Well, I guess the chicken and the egg was seeing the Everglades article as having 9 paragraphs and no citations, and thinking it was, you know, almost criminal to see that, you know, 900 people a day read that, and it was nothing. It was really, really poorly written and had no citations to it, and it's just a massive part of the wilderness area of Florida, and a good reason why lots of people come here. And then to find out that it's got nothing. So, you know, I go and I try to find, actually my first place I stopped was the bookstore of Everglades National Park. And then find out what those people are saying about it. What do newspaper stories say? Marjorie Stoneman Douglas wrote a lot about it. So you read about what she wrote, and she wrote about some people, and you go find what they wrote about it. And then you go find where they've been cited in other things. And it's almost like Wikipedia itself, where one click brings you so far that you can't remember where you started.
Right. Okay, so we got our sources, we know our topic, and then the next step is taking notes. Some of us start writing right away. I don't know who wants to start talking about the process of actually putting it all together. Phil, you had something you wanted to say, or did you want to start us off here?
Well, I was just going to say something else came to mind. A lot of times when you're going into a new field, there's specialized language, and so sometimes it can be a little tricky to ferret that out. One of the tools I like is OneLook.com. Last time I checked, which was, that was about 6 months ago, it searched through something like 900 dictionaries simultaneously, and it's probably more than that now. And I go through the definitions of unfamiliar terms that are in some specialized area, and I might go through, you know, I might get 100 or 200 hits in different dictionaries, some of them very specialized medical dictionaries or legal dictionaries, and I'll go through the range of definitions. I'll go and check in the OED and Webster's. A lot of times in the footnotes in those dictionaries, they'll have interesting information, and that can really help flesh out your background information when you're really researching one of these topics you may be less familiar with, or some kind of more obscure aspects. Maybe somebody, you know, wrote about it in the 1500s or 1600s, and that's mentioned in the OED, and you will find that out when you're digging around, and that can be very, very helpful, I was going to say. So that's all I was going to add. Yeah. It's just a plug for OneLook.com. Yeah. It's a great tool.
Add one point about researching, also, the librarians can be extremely helpful. I know that, for example, if I wanted to go back to that medical article, I would go and I would find a medical reference librarian, because that would be the person who would help me figure out which of these sources is going to be most helpful and which is most obscure. I mean, when you really don't know how to research something, you should ask someone who does know.
Right.
And they can provide you with, you know, specific area recommendations. So that's just what I was going to say. Always ask for help.
Yeah, and I would say that the wiki projects are also really useful in that regard, because when I was working on MUnother, you know, I could go to the people at the wiki math project and say, you know, look, I'm lost. Where do I start? And they were able to point me to some really good sources, not only in terms of like which libraries to look at or what publication types, but also, you know, specific texts that were like, okay, this doesn't have, you know, her name in it, or it doesn't seem like it's specifically about her, but then it, you know, becomes a very useful thing later on. And also, if you can get someone like Willow to come on and like do all the math for you, that's a really good thing to do for, you know, articles like that, because, you know, she just took it away. So, well, I'll say, you know, just real quick about the process of writing and taking notes. I mean, usually when I start in researching a topic, I'm so fired up about it at the start of it that I want to actually start composing, and I don't go through and, you know, some people like to go through and take all their notes first and read everything and get a really comprehensive sense of the whole scope of it, but I always find that, especially when I'm writing biography articles, you know, this stuff in different biographies obviously is going to vary in terms of which details it includes and whatnot and how much depth it goes into, but there is a general sense, okay, this person was born in this town, and so I can get information about that, and usually, you know, piece it together as I go, and then obviously as I get more into it, I can go back and revise a little bit, but there comes a point, it seems, where I usually have to stop and pull back and say, okay, now where's the rest of it going to expand into, and how much depth am I going to put into this area or that area?
So you write sort of, and research at the same time.
I pretty much do. You know, my parents bought me this book about Leonardo da Vinci when I was a kid, and I don't know how true it is, but, you know, the story was in the book that, you know, his parents bought him paints, and he was really into painting for a while, and then he got tired with that, so they bought him clay, and he, you know, played with the clay for a while. And I think I'm like that. Like, I can't stay focused on just one thing. I guess they call it attention deficit disorder now, but I'm just so interested in whatever it is I'm working on that I just want to go ahead and see some of that finished product right off the bat, even if it means I have to go, but it's not going to be the finished product, but I have to see, you know, the end form of it in some shape or form, and it feels like I'm making that progress as I go. And then, of course, you know, it has its negatives, because I need to go back and revise stuff that I've written before once I find another book. Oh, this has this other information in it. But it's my own, I guess it's my temperament. It's the way that I have to follow that, you know, excitement and keep it moving so that I don't find myself, you know, sort of bogged down by the actual research process.
I guess I'm sort of the reverse, in the sense that I like to have I take a lot of notes when I read, and part of that's because I want to have the notes for my own, you know, writing, like on my dissertation or my future career, so it's useful for me, but also because I want to be able to arrange all my little quotations that I've taken from the sources and see, oh yes, you know, in History of a 6 Weeks Tour by Mary Shelley, you know, four different scholars have talked about the Sublime, therefore I have to talk about the Sublime, where, you know, only one scholar has talked about the issue of the romance, therefore for, that's less important, you know, and I can see that right there in the numbers and in the quotations or, you know, something like that. I mean, I write entire sections when I know I'm not going to have any more research on a particular area. Like, I know I've got all the background on Mary Shelley's rambles in Germany and Italy, and I'm not going to have any more background information on that. So I've written that now, but I still, that article is still a red link because I don't want to put up one part of the article without having the rest of it, which I think, you know, brings up the question about the sandbox, because I do have that article in a sandbox right now. And we were talking about whether or not that's a good way to write or a wiki way to write. And so there are, you know, advantages and disadvantages to the sandbox.
Yeah. I want to explore that just a second. Moni, do you have anything about, like, your process in terms of, you know, do you take notes? Do you start writing right away? Do you do both? Do you do neither?
Well, Skartel, you and I should be in, like, a room writing together, and I'm sure it would be, like, the funnest thing to watch of all time, because I start off, if somebody actually watched this and tried to document the way I write, they would just be appalled. They would just shocked. I'm what I consider to be extraordinarily undisciplined and a very passion-based, just like you are. So whatever it is that captures me at the moment is what I'm going to write about. And if it's that, you know, that one aspect of the story that that really has captured my imagination, then I'll focus on that part of the article, and then I'll expand it from there. And you also spoke about the attention deficit disorder type of all over the place, and even Leonardo da Vinci's painting. And I am a painter, or actually I was. I stopped painting about a year ago. I'm going to pick it up
when
back
you found
again. Let's not make that connection right now, because I'd rather not get into that. However, I also noticed the same thing when I started a painting. It wasn't very pretty until I hit one point, and whatever that one point was, then that painting, I could see the finish of it. I could see how it was going to end and how good it was going to look at the end. And then at the same time, when I'm writing an article, I kind of hit a point where all these kind of weird, disjointed facts come into, and all of a sudden you have a story, and that story is going to be a very, very good article, and that's when it starts to make a lot more sense, and the writing is a lot less frantic and a lot more fun, I guess, towards the end. I don't know, the beginning is also just as fun.
And it can cause problems on my end. I mean, the reason I put Emily Pankhurst on hold for, you know, a month is because I started into it when I was during summer break, and it was great, and I had all this time, and I could really focus, and then school started, and suddenly I had absolutely no time, and so I had to just put it to the back. And I think it was for that reason that I was really glad I did that in a sandbox. You know, for those who don't know, sandboxing is when you basically write the article in your user space. You'll create a subpage. Some of us have, you know, actual sandboxes devoted, or, you know, a canvas or drawing board or whatever you call it, and you do sort of a first draft of it in your own namespace, and that way, you know, people aren't coming in making edits, you don't have IP concerns, you know, people anonymously changing things. And for me, you know, when I'm doing a first draft of an article that I expect to take to featured article status, you know, I want it to be something I can completely devote everything of my own to, and not have to worry that I have to go back later and change things that somebody else has changed, or you know, just check to make sure that they're, you know, valid as I go. I figure I can start doing that once it's in the main namespace. And I understand that some people are concerned because that feels like there's an ownership problem there. But, you know, from where I stand, like, look, you know, most of the articles that I've written, I'm devoting, you know, days literally of my life to this work. And I think that a little bit of that kind of, you know, research-based protectionism is not out of order, you know, and that I deserve a little bit of privacy to make that first draft. And it's not like I'm going to say, oh, it can never be changed after I write it. It's just that while I'm doing that first phase of the work, I just want to be left alone so I can come up with what I've got. And then I can say, okay, here you go. You know, everybody in the world can obviously go and do what they will to it.
I have something I could add about that.
You had something on the sandbox.
Yes. Yeah. When I first got onto Wikipedia, people kept saying sandbox, sandbox. I didn't know what the heck they were talking about. I didn't even understand it. I didn't even know where to find out about it or even how to start one. And I probably have pretty close to 100 articles sitting in sandboxes, or rewrites of articles sitting in sandbox at the moment. Now, I don't always go by the sandbox. Use sandbox versions, although I have quite a few of them. Sometimes if there's an article that's, you know, at some stage, primitive stage, and I see it's missing a piece or needs a little bit of tweaking, add some extra information that's lacking, I'll just do it right there on the fly, and it'll evolve in the main space. Other times, especially if it's an article about something I don't know very much about, or a complete rewrite of an article that's already out there, and I don't want, as Skartal was talking about, I don't want other people monkeying with it while I'm trying to do it, and I'm just trying to get up to speed, I'll do it in a sandbox. So as an example, I have had almost a year now, I've had falsifiability, I don't even know what I'm going to call it eventually, but evolution and falsifiability or what have you, something to do with the concept, philosophy of science, concept of falsifiability initiated by Karl Popper, I'm no philosopher, and how it pertains to evolution. And the reason I came to this is I've worked a lot, as people probably know, on intelligent design articles and creationism articles, and this is a very prominent part of the discussion and the disputes between evolutionary biology and creationists or intelligent design supporters. And I didn't really know much about it because, you know, when you get a PhD in the physical sciences, you don't really care what the philosophers are talking about. I mean, you don't care. Well, they're just a bunch of nitwits over there in the humanities area. You don't care what they think, and you don't pay attention to what they say. And this is a very important part of this debate. So I thought, well, I got to learn something about it. So I started it off in the sandbox. And I think I read an awful lot of stuff about it. And I think even my draft here is probably the most complete thing you'll find anywhere on the web at this point. It's maybe got 200 or 300 references, although it's still lacking a few. I need to make another few passes at it. Then when I got it to a point where I thought, okay, this is kind of getting there, I then had, you know, having worked on Wikipedia for a while, I've got a family of people that I know, friends that I know are similar maniacs in the same area as me, experts of one type and another, and, you know, real, you know, biology PhDs or philosophy PhDs or people who are very, very well versed in this debate between creationism and evolution. And I invited them in. I guess I've had about 4 or 5 I've invited them in selectively to come and edit in my sandbox. So they then have the privilege of then, in uninterrupted fashion, without having to deal with edit warring and so on, they will make a pass, and I leave them alone to do that. And they, you know, because I've chosen well, there's almost nothing I disagree with. They've all added to it considerably. And then it eventually I'll fill in the missing references that I still feel I need, missing red links, and then I'll go live at some point, maybe in the next few months, and I believe this will really fill a substantial chunk of needed discourse in this whole area, of which Wikipedia occupies a very prominent place. I mean, we get some of our articles get many hundreds of thousands of hits per year, and you know, lots of them get 50,000 to 100,000 hits a month. So we do actually occupy a very important place in this entire discussion, which is ongoing.
Yeah, you know, it's really wild that you mentioned Karl Popper, Phil, because there's a really good podcast coming out of Australia called The Philosopher's Zone. If you search for Philosopher's Zone, you'll find the link to it. And they just recently had a show all about Karl Popper, so it's really fortuitous that comes up right now. And I think that, you know, to me, that has to do with the question of sort of a little bit of deliberate, calm review of the basic concepts before we start. You know, when there's an edit war going on, or when there's somebody who's charging that, you know, this must be included, this has to be excluded, it seems like there's a need to have a definitive decision made right then and there, and that it's something that the passions are so inflamed about that this is one thing that seems like a good argument in favor of sandboxing to a degree is that we can sort of take our time and slowly deliberate, okay, rationally speaking, trying, you know, giving that we're, assuming that we have good faith, we're trying to include every, you know, reasonable element of it. And it's a way for us to calmly and rationally sort through it all without having to, you know, have, you know, individual editors bringing in a specific point of view saying, you know, oh, well, this has to be included, and trying to force a decision rather than sort of looking at it with some dispassion, if that can be done. And obviously we're all individuals and there's that whole debacle to be sorted through. But I don't know if you had thoughts about sandboxing and whatnot.
Well, to be the devil's advocate, let me present some arguments against sandboxes. Actually, when I did interviews for my Wikimedia